Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Bella, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop. And today's program focuses on update on epithelioid sarcoma. And today's program, we have very distinguished faculty on the program today, speakers, and this program is supported by Ipsen Biopharmaceuticals, Inc. I really want to thank them for their support of this program. Now, before I introduce our first, and I also want to just let you know how many people are on the call today. So we have over 61 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the world, from both the United States, from all different parts of the United States, from urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Argentina, Finland, the Netherlands, Philippines, and the United Kingdom. So it is a global call as well. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Jonathan Trent. And Dr. Trent is Professor of Medicine, Associate Director, Clinical Research, Director of Precision Medicine, Leader of Sarcoma Site Disease Group, Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center at the Miller School of Medicine, University of Miami. And Dr. Trent will be addressing three topics: an overview of epithelioid sarcoma, the role of the pathologist, the importance of the pathology report, and the role of surgery, chemotherapy, radiation, and targeted therapies. It is my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Trent.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. I'm delighted to participate in our discussion today with these other fabulous panelists on the topic of epithelioid sarcoma. Sarcoma is a rare type of cancer in the U.S. There may be anywhere from 15 to 20,000 patients diagnosed each year, making it a very rare type of cancer. It's 1% or less of all cancers. Epithelioid sarcoma is a rare malignant soft tissue sarcoma that accounts for less than 1% of all sarcomas. So that means there may be 100 or even less, or somewhere around 100 new patients diagnosed each year with epithelioid sarcoma. So it's a very, very rare entity. Like other sarcomas, it's also distinct and it arises from the mesenchymal or deeper tissues, not from the epithelial or lining cells that are common in the common types of cancer called carcinomas. Now, clinically, epithelioid sarcoma has two basic types. The distal type, which is more common, affects young adults, arises in the distal extremities, such as the hand, toes, forearm, foreleg. And then the proximal type, which is more aggressive, occurs in the deeper soft tissues, in the pelvis, in the trunk, in the retroperitoneum. Diagnostically, a patient may present with a slow-growing, painless mass, often misdiagnosed by a primary care physician or in the emergency room as something benign, such as an infection or a hematoma, collection of blood after an accident. However, as it grows, it may ulcerate or the skin may break down. These are also rare in sarcomas in that they may affect the lymph nodes. There can be spread to regional lymph nodes, which is unusual for most sarcoma types. Key to the diagnosis and management of epithelioid sarcoma is the role of an experienced sarcoma pathologist. In fact, in our national guidelines for sarcoma, we always recommend that that biopsy or surgical material be reviewed by an experienced sarcoma pathologist. This is largely due to the fact that 25% of the time, a experienced sarcoma pathologist will change the diagnosis in a major way, such that it's a different type of cancer or the treatment is different. That's almost 1 in 4 patients who have their material reviewed by a sarcoma pathologist. There is a change, a major change that affects either the diagnosis or the treatment. So it's a critical first step. When the pathologists diagnose epithelioid sarcoma, they look at the way it looks under the microscope, and they'll see epithelioid cells, hence the name epithelioid sarcoma, because the cells are somewhat cuboidal or square-shaped like skin cells. However, there may be spindle cells. There's also a nodular growth pattern that the pathologists recognize, and a high mitotic rate, meaning the cells look like they're growing fast. Then the pathologist, to help further confirm the diagnosis, the pathologists will also look at proteins expressed on the tumor cells using antibodies that are specific to various proteins that are associated with epithelioid sarcoma, such as cytokeratins, epithelioid membrane antigen, vimentin, CD34. But really the most important protein diagnostically for epithelioid sarcoma is a protein called INI1, or sometimes it's called SMARCB1. And that protein the loss of that protein occurs in more than 90% of epithelioid sarcoma patients. If SMARCB1, INI1 are retained on the tumor cells, we may even question the diagnosis as an epithelioid sarcoma. These are almost uniformly lost in epithelioid sarcoma. This is because at the genetic level, the SMARCB1 or INI1 gene will have an alteration. This alteration will result at the genetic level at the inability to turn the DNA to RNA into a protein. And like I said, this is very important fundamentally for the formation of epithelioid sarcoma and also for the diagnosis. And then once a diagnosis is made, we will order certain imaging for the primary tumor, often an MRI, especially the distal type. We'll do a CT of the chest to assess for lung metastases. We'll also do lymph node imaging. If there's a suspicious lymph node, we might do an ultrasound-guided biopsy or an ultrasound of the lymph node in epithelioid sarcoma, although it's rare in other sarcoma subtypes. Now, surgery is really the mainstay of treatment for localized disease. The aim is a complete resection with wide negative margins, and epithelioid sarcoma, having wide margins is really critical. If an unplanned excision is performed with close margins, a wide local excision is indicated. And the larger margins are generally better because the local recurrence rate is around 30 to 50%, even with an optimal surgery. Lymph node involvement can be 15 to 30%. So if a lymph node looks suspicious, it should be biopsied. There may be sentinel lymph node analysis performed where a suspicious lymph node, either from dye or radiation, could be impacted, and there may be a role for removing lymph nodes in this entity, different from other sarcoma types. Now, in addition to surgery, we often use other therapeutic approach. There's this concept in sarcoma that multidisciplinary management often leads to the best outcomes. So radiation therapy is also often used. Generally, before surgery, we prefer preoperative radiation at our center due to the observation that a lower dose may be used, 50 gray, rather than a 65 to 70 gray dose for postoperative radiation. Radiation is indicated for close or positive margins, deep tumors, large tumors, and it helps decrease the local recurrence rate. It will not impact distant recurrence, but it can reduce the chance of an epithelioid sarcoma recurring at the original site where it started, and is used in, I believe, at least in our center, is used very frequently with epithelioid sarcoma. The most common use is a type of external radiation called intensity modulated radiation therapy. There may be role for proton therapy in certain conditions, but this is generally the decision that the radiation therapist makes based on optimal treatment of the tumor with the minimal treatment of normal tissue. In addition to surgery and radiation, there is a role for systemic therapy, meaning therapy that goes throughout the entire body. This could be chemotherapy that is used prior to surgery, after surgery, or in the set of advanced or metastatic when the epithelioid sarcoma has spread to other organs. Chemotherapy in a localized primary epithelioid sarcoma does have some controversy. Data may support use of chemotherapy in the tumor larger than 5 centimeters that's high grade. The smaller tumors are definitely controversial, and sometimes chemotherapy is used to decrease the tumor so that it can be pulled away from vessels, blood vessels, nerves, to downstage the type of surgery that might be needed. And also in epithelioid sarcoma, we use chemotherapy at times in a limb-sparing approach. First-line chemotherapy is generally doxorubicin plus ifosfamide are the two agents that are used. These agents do have some toxicity, so may not be full standard dose of both agents may not be appropriate for every patient. There may be patients who would be treated with lower doses of ifosfamide or even doxorubicin as a single agent. Second line therapy is generally gemcitabine plus docetaxel, although other alternatives, third line and beyond, include pazopanib as an approach. There's a newer agent called tazemetostat, EZH2 inhibitor, that Dr. Miriam is going to discuss in a little bit more detail. And then there's some experimental approaches that are intriguing to all of us, especially in a rare disease. We're not going to be able to do clinical trials of 500 patients in 2 or 3 different arms of therapy for epithelioid sarcoma because it's so rare. But other therapies such as immunotherapy, metabolomic approaches are all intriguing and being explored in clinical trials. And so that's a summary of the role of the pathologist and the use of the approach of pathologists to make the critical diagnosis that's not always easy in epithelioid sarcoma, the need for expert pathologist and should be required expert pathologist review at diagnosis, and then a multidisciplinary treatment approach is generally best for most patients. I'd like to thank you for your attention, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Trent. That was just an outstanding presentation, stellar. And you, since you're the first speaker, you really set the tone for today's program. So a lot of information, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Priscilla Miriam, and Dr. Miriam is Senior Physician, Medical Oncology, Clinical Director, Sarcoma Center, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And Dr. Miriam will be addressing new treatment approaches, update on epithelioid clinical trials, how research increases treatment options, and managing treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort, quality of life concerns, pain management, and supportive care. It is my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Miriam.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. Thank you as well, Dr. Trent, for that excellent introduction to epithelioid sarcoma. I'm honored to be with all of you today to discuss these very important topics. As Dr. Trent reviewed, some of the systemic therapy or chemotherapy options already, I will only mention briefly some options that we consider when we need medications for the treatment of epithelioid sarcoma. As Dr. Trent outlined already nicely, we think about using medications for epithelioid sarcoma both when we may wish to try to change a localized epithelioid sarcoma, whether we want to change it if possible to make surgery easier, or as he mentioned, whether there may be people wish to pursue what's called adjuvant chemotherapy after surgery, which Dr. Trent explained. There is some controversy or discussion in the field and between patients and doctors about whether that type of approach with chemotherapy is appropriate for one individual person. Otherwise, we think about using systemic therapy or medications for individuals who have advanced or metastatic epithelioid sarcoma when we're looking to try to control the epithelioid sarcoma for as long as we can. So chemotherapy options include many options, as Dr. Trent outlined, and some of the most commonly used options include drugs in the class of anthracyclines, like doxorubicin or liposomal doxorubicin. Also, gemcitabine-based regimens are frequently used as well, either gemcitabine alone or gemcitabine plus docetaxel, as Dr. Trent described. The goal, again, with these medications is to try to control the growth of the epithelioid sarcoma for as long as possible in the setting of advanced or metastatic epithelioid sarcoma. Most recently in 2020, an oral medication called tazemetostat was approved by the FDA. This drug was designed to target something called EZH2, which is a protein that can promote the growth of epithelioid sarcoma cancer cells. Tazemetostat can provide control of epithelioid sarcoma, and the side effect profile with tazemetostat is somewhat different from that which is seen with traditional chemotherapy. With chemotherapy drugs, we may see issues with hair loss, fatigue, nausea, low blood counts. Rarely there may be issues with function of the heart, in terms of the pumping function of the heart, among other potential side effects. Toxicities that have been reported with tazemetostat also include some of these same side effects, but in general, the side effects tend to be milder, so a more mild fatigue or a mild decrease in blood counts. As I'll discuss a little bit later, all of these side effects are toxicities that they may not happen to each person who receives either chemotherapy or a targeted therapy like tazemetostat, and your treatment team will work very closely with you to help manage any side effects that could arise with the use of any of these medications. So clinical trials are a very important part of our job in helping to take care of people with epithelioid sarcoma and for helping us to learn more about how to best treat sarcomas. I always discuss clinical trial options with people who come to see me because participation in a trial may provide a unique opportunity to increase treatment options for any one individual. Currently, clinical trials for people with epithelioid sarcoma are really focused on testing new agents that are similar to the currently approved EZH2 inhibitor, tazemetostat, that I previously described. There are currently a few phase one trials or first in human trials, which are investigating doses or amount of the drug and side effects of these agents. And the hope is, the researchers are hoping that these drugs that they're being tested will be even more effective than tazemetostat, the currently available EZH2 inhibitor. Another area of interest in the epithelioid sarcoma research community currently is the potential for a role of immunotherapy in treatment of epithelioid sarcoma. There are several clinical trials currently ongoing testing different combinations of immunotherapy agents or testing them in combination with tazemetostat, for example. We are all looking forward to hearing the results of these clinical trials at our meetings in the years to come. We're learning more every year about promising approaches for treating epithelioid sarcoma, and that is because of people like you who have participated in trials, who have wanted to partner in learning more about epithelioid sarcoma together. If you're interested in discovering more about clinical trials, you can look at the government website, the U.S. government website, clinicaltrials.gov, clinicaltrials.gov, where you can search for a clinical trial that might be of interest for you, if you think that participating in a clinical trial might be right. You can also ask your doctor, who can help you determine whether clinical trials or what clinical trials might be options for you. The goal of everyone on your treatment team is to help you feel better and to work to make every day the best possible. This can sometimes mean working to manage treatment side effects or symptoms from the cancer itself. When you're talking to your doctor about medication options, it's important to have an open and frank discussion about what potential side effects you might experience from treatment and to make sure that you feel that the potential benefit of treatment seems greater than the potential for side effects. Some side effects you may wish to ask about could be fatigue, hair loss, nausea, fertility impacts, or others. Your treatment team should be very experienced in helping you to treat any side effects that you might experience. But you can also ask them how to prevent side effects. Sometimes medications can be given to decrease the risk of nausea or the risk of infections after chemotherapy, for example. Your treatment team should be very experienced in helping you feel as though you were able to tolerate any side effects that arise related to treatment that you're having. And if not, then that's an important time to talk with your treatment team about whether a different approach is important for you. Some centers may have a symptom management team, also sometimes called a palliative care team, who are experts in symptom management and in pain management, among other things. You can ask your doctor if this is available at your center. Additionally, there are many other important team members who can help you feel supported in other important ways beyond just the physical, such as the team of social workers, or individuals who can provide spiritual support like chaplains, or complementary therapists who could help with things like exercise, massage, acupuncture, and other supportive therapies. I'd like to close my portion by thanking you again for inviting me to be part of this important discussion today. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Miriam. That was just a wonderful presentation. Outstanding, and you covered a lot of really important things for patients to learn about. So I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Chirag Kapadia, and Dr. Kapadia is Fellow, Department of Hematology, Medical Oncology, Andrew Weil Center for Integrative Medicine, University of Arizona. And Dr. Kapadia will be addressing preparing for telehealth, telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, follow-up care, and discussion of open notes, and also key questions to ask your healthcare team, and stress management suggestions and tips. It's my pleasure now to give this program, turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Kapadia.
Thank you for that introduction, Dr. Messner, as well as the amazing presentations by Drs. Trent and Miriam. As Dr. Messner stated, I'm going to be shifting the focus a bit into the following topics: addressing preparing for telemedicine appointments, key questions to ask your healthcare team, as well as stress management suggestions and tips for patients, loved ones, and other support systems as we continue through our healthcare journeys. So just to begin with preparing for telehealth / telemedicine appointments, you know, a good kind of thing to do potentially before your appointment is making sure that your technology is prepared for the appointment itself. You can do platform checks, for example, if you're using Zoom, Doximity, MyChart, potentially download, you know, needing to download apps or applications in advance before the appointment and then testing them out, as well as testing out your device. You can usually do this through these apps, testing computers with cameras and microphones, making sure you have a stable internet connection, and such as that. In terms of, you know, just general preparation, having some information readily available for your telemedicine provider, if possible, would be appreciated. I'm sure they'll have looked through some of these, you know, some of your medical history as well, but having your sarcoma diagnosis, the type, grade, stage available if possible, an estimate of the date of diagnosis, as well as potential treatments that have been completed, any major recent scans or labs, medications and supplement changes that have happened, as well as recent symptoms or side effects, having these kind of listed or written down, potentially even in a phone notes app, for example, can keep you organized for, you know, for the time limit that you have with your appointment at a provider. Additionally, preparing potentially some list of questions just to help kind of guide the conversation as well could be utilized throughout the time period. Some of these questions could include, you know, diagnosis and prognosis, such as what type of sarcomas do I have, and what does that mean for my prognosis? Is the sarcoma considered high grade or aggressive? You know, addressing questions in terms of treatment. What are the next steps in treatment? Any changes since the last visit? Any clinical trials, as we've previously discussed, that might be available for your type of sarcoma. Symptom management, such as how you can manage pain, fatigue, neuropathy, and such, as well as life and wellness questions. You know, general things. Can I exercise? Can I return to work? When can I return to work? Are there any integrative or supportive care options available at the center or that the provider utilizes? And then, you know, having a list of things to make sure to close the call with, such as follow-up and next steps. You know, ask the provider, what happens next? Are there any new labs, images, treatments coming up my way? When is my next appointment? Should I reach out if something worsens, or if I haven't heard back, should I reach out? You can also ask about referrals, prescriptions, and who to call if you have any side effects, questions, or emergent issues. Another thing that you can do is use open notes discussion. Some EHRs or electronic healthcare records or these portals have ways for you to access your oncologist's clinical notes, as well as other images, labs, and things that are completed. And so these can also be kind of, you know, accessed via patient through their patient portals. But you can also ask your provider, you know, if you can access their notes in the chart, what to specifically look in their notes, if they put any specific, you know, important information at the end or the beginning, things such as that. And then finally, just a bonus tip, having a support person on the call nearby, you know, or ready just to help remember things that you may have discussed, just to also have a second person hearing what the provider is saying and kind of getting a second understanding. You can also consider recording with permission, of course, the visit or some sort of other recording method so that you have the information, you know, that you guys discussed. Now, in regards to some key questions that you can ask your healthcare team, we kind of discussed, you know, understanding the diagnosis, understanding what type of sarcoma do I have, where exactly is the tumor located, what stage and grade is it, what does that mean, has it spread or metastasized, is it localized? Additionally, in terms of testing and imaging, what additional tests or scans will I need? How often will I need imaging? Will you be doing genetic testing, molecular profiling, things like that? And then discussing with your provider, what are the treatment options in your situation or scenario? Are surgery, radiation, chemotherapy all necessary, or, you know, are we looking at some other forms of treatment that may use just surgery or just radiation? What might the side effects be, and how can I manage some of these symptoms? And then additionally, are there any supportive therapies that you provide or that your clinic provides? Are there any integrative therapies that may help? These might include acupuncture, nutritional support, mindfulness. Asking your provider if they work with physical therapists, social workers, nutritionists to kind of help build that care team for yourself. And also other resources for transportation, financial aid, lodging if needed for traveling for treatment, which can be further elucidated with the healthcare team as well. Finally, you know, questions about follow-up and coordination. What is the schedule of my treatment and follow-up? Who's going to be my main point of contact? How often will I have follow-up scans or visits after treatments, and what signs of, you know, recurrence or symptoms should I be watching out for? And then also planning for the future. What does survivorship look like for sarcoma? Are there risks of late effects of treatment down the road, even months after treatment could be completed? How can I plan for work, family, fertility, and long-term quality of life? And finally, moving into the final portion of my discussion, stress management suggestions and tips. Understandably, this is a very difficult time period for both patients as well as their loved ones. But what are ways that we can best support ourselves, support our loved ones, support patients going through these, you know, these therapies and all of these appointments? Oftentimes, I like to suggest mind-body practices. These are therapies that can help calm down the nervous system, reduce anxiety, fatigue, and pain as well. Some of my suggestions to my patients include breathing exercises, for example, trying 4-7-8 breathing or circle breathing just to help regulate that, you know, nervous system and regulate anxiety as well. Guided imagery or meditation apps can be quite helpful, whether that be apps such as Headspace, Insight Timer, or things such as using YouTube videos. To help with guided imagery or meditation. This also helps with progressive muscle relaxation, which uses a tension relaxation kind of guided method to help provide reductions in anxiety, pain, such as that. Additionally, yoga, gentle exercises, gentle stretching, tai chi are other options that can also help incorporate some physical activity as well as mind-body practices together. Another thing that's often a great recommendation for patients is journaling and emotionally expressing what you're feeling. Putting thoughts down onto paper and physically getting it out there can help reduce that feeling of overwhelming just amount of stuff coming at you, and also give you a little bit of perspective in terms of your journey so far and everything that you've overcome. You can also try to incorporate art therapy, music therapy if available at your cancer center, or again, looking things up on YouTube for free educational videos or support videos. Additionally, thinking about connection and support, seeing if there are oncology counselors, therapists available that your cancer center works with, your provider works with, joining sarcoma support groups, whether that be with the Sarcoma Alliance, cancer support communities, Facebook, and other options to help lean on with friends, families, and other patients going through similar situations. And then looking at rest, nutrition, daily rhythm, as in sleep hygiene, balanced eating, balanced meals, staying hydrated, and having a daily structure, even simple routines to bring you and keep you more grounded into that day-to-day, things that are going on. And so there, just to close off this section, there are lots of, potential resources that are available. Oftentimes, many cancer centers will have survivorship programs or other resource kind of, programs to help build your care team, including social work, nutrition, counseling, and such. And so there are resources available, and, be open with your providers to discuss what options there might be for your situation. Thank you so much, and I'd like to thank my esteemed colleagues as well for their inputs throughout this presentation.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kapadia. That was just a fantastic presentation and covering some such important areas for our participants. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you so much, and particularly around stress management. suggestions and tips. I'm sure that will be a very interesting topic for people to hear from you on. I'm just going to say a few words about cancer care services. Cancer care offers free national programs and services to people living with all types of cancer, as well as caregivers. And those services include a range of programs. We offer practical, financial, and co-payment assistance to help with the costs of cancer treatment. We also offer online support groups for both patients, their caregivers, families, spouses, loved ones, LGBTQ community, so support groups for everyone. And those are online, and you can visit them on our website, www.cancercare.org. You'll be able to see all of the services that we offer on the website. You also can call our HOPE line, 800-813-4673. The HOPE line is staffed by oncology social workers. They queue up and take your questions, so there's no wait time to speak to someone, and they'll be able to address any question that you may have. Many times people will call, they would like to get some support services, or they need some practical help, or the range of questions that people ask, and so they get an answer right away, and then they're assigned for follow-up care as well. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A. I'm going to ask Bella to explain to you how to queue up the questions. Bella?
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. At this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
And so we have a question now for Dr. Trent. Is there a common site where epithelioid sarcoma starts to grow? For Dr. Trent, is there a common site where epithelioid sarcoma starts to grow?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, there are common sites for epithelioid sarcoma being the distal extremities, hands, feet, forelegs, and then also the proximal type, which would involve often the pelvic area. Those are the two most common locations that we see epithelioid sarcoma arise, although other anatomic locations are not unheard of.
Thank you. And another question for you, Dr. Trent. Are there specific risk factors for epithelioid sarcoma? Is there a demographic most impacted by this diagnosis?
Well, it's one of those types of cancer, types of sarcoma that tend to affect younger individuals, although any age group can affect it.
Okay. And a question for Dr. Miriam: Are any of the risks associated with epithelioid sarcoma inherited?
Hi, thanks. That's a great question. You know, we're learning more and more about potential risk factors for developing sarcoma. There are a number of studies that are ongoing for people who are interested in having their non-cancer cells tested. That's also called the germline genetic testing. And in some of the testing that we're doing, there is maybe around a quarter of individuals with sarcoma that we may find a germline, something in the germline or the non-cancer cells that may be an increased risk of developing cancer. Not necessarily sarcoma, but there are a number of genes that that we have information about that if we see an alteration in that gene, that there may be an increased risk of developing a type of cancer over your lifetime. So there are many people who are interested in learning more about inherited risks of cancer, and because we're testing more and more individuals, we are seeing that there is that there are probably around 25% or so of people with sarcoma in general who may have an increased risk of cancer, not necessarily sarcoma, but of cancer in general. And the reason that we're interested in this type of approach is that if you can find a potential for an inherited risk of cancer, doesn't mean you would ever develop the cancer, but if that is found in you or in a relative, it empowers you to have the chance to perhaps have your individual cancer screening modified for you. So instead of having a colonoscopy every 10 years, for example, if there were a gene discovered in a family member or in you that could potentially be an increased risk for developing colon cancer, not sarcoma, then there may be a different recommendation for you in terms of how often a colonoscopy would be recommended. So I say all that to just give a little background that I think there's really important work that's coming out about learning about genes that may give us a chance to be more proactive to try to screen, to tailor our screening for cancer in general, based on what we find, looking for these genes that we have some information about. Again, all that said, we may find genes for people with sarcoma that are not at all related to the sarcoma that they did develop, so they may have a potential risk for breast cancer or another type of cancer. For epithelioid sarcoma specifically, I'm happy to hear from my colleagues. I'm not aware of one particular gene that we know of that tends to increase the risk of developing epithelioid sarcoma in particular. So there's not one gene that I know of, but I did want to take the opportunity to comment generally that there's a lot of work being done to try to understand more about whether there are inherited risks for different types of cancers, of course sarcomas, but all cancers, and if we find out some information, how could you use that to help be proactive and help to tailor even better your personal cancer prevention or early detection? Dr. Trent, Dr. Kapadi, I don't know if you have other comments specifically about that.
Thank you. Thank you. What others would like to add?
No, I agree with you 100%, Dr. Merriam. There's not a clear hereditary syndrome associated with epithelioid sarcoma.
Agreed. And, yeah, okay. Another question. Is it still correct to say that the majority of epithelioid sarcoma patients are children, young adults? What are the typical age range of this cohort? Dr. Trent, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, the epithelioid sarcoma, remember there's distal type and then there's proximal type. The distal type tends to affect younger individuals. These can be anywhere from the age, even in the teens, but typically 20 to 40 years of age, but could even be in the teens. And the proximal type is slightly older, maybe in the 30s to 50s, but this is generally thought of as one of the adolescent young adult type cancers.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Are PET scans used for imaging? Dr. Kapadia, do you want to comment on that?
Can you repeat the question real quick, son?
Are PET scans used for imaging?
PET scans can be used for imaging. Traditionally, in terms of sarcoma, we use various forms of imaging. MRIs can give us a little bit more information in terms of soft tissue involvement, which may be helpful, especially for the surgeons to delineate, their approaches for resection. And so we do use them, but, additional images are also utilized depending on what kind of you know, what we're using the images for. For example, in terms of staging to help us determine, you know, the extent of disease, then yes, the PET scan may be helpful. But again, other images may be also warranted, or imaging modalities may be warranted to help us fully elucidate out, you know, surgical techniques, for example, and things like that as well. Correct me if you guys think otherwise, Dr. Trent or Miriam.
Does anyone want to add to that?
I would agree. I think every imaging modality has its particular strengths, and you may wish to you or your team may recommend one particular imaging modality at one time or another, depending on what the question is. PET scans sometimes can be helpful when we're trying to determine if a lymph node may potentially be contained or be involved by epithelioid sarcoma. As Dr. Trent mentioned, in general, lymph nodes are less commonly involved in sarcomas, but epithelioid sarcoma is one of those subtypes of sarcomas that can go to lymph nodes. And if there's some uncertainty about whether a lymph node that's slightly swollen, if there may be epithelioid sarcoma in that lymph node, sometimes a PET scan can give additional information. It really depends on the question.
And for Dr. Kapadia, do you have any tips on how to start exercising to combat fatigue? I read that exercise can help with fatigue, but I don't even know where to start. If you could comment on that.
Of course. That is a great question. In the long term, although exercise may feel like it, you know, takes up a lot of your energy in the short term, in the long term, studies have shown that patients who increase their overall activity level end up noticing less degrees of fatigue, as well as other healthcare-related quality of life, you know, just issues. It can help with anxiety as well as other mental health kind of related issues with the diagnosis as well. It is a good question to discuss where to start with. Oftentimes with sarcomas, depending on maybe the location, you know, if an amputation, for example, is needed or resection is needed, this may hinder certain exercise modalities. So usually, depending a little bit patient to patient, if you can start off slow by incorporating maybe some sort of walking into your kind of exercise regime, just to get something slowly to build up that, you know, tolerance, and that can, over a long-term period, can increase, you know, for example, starting maybe with just 5 minutes of walking with breaks in between and doing 20 minutes a day, potentially, going towards maybe 30 minutes at a time of walking with 30 minutes a day. Additionally, sometimes patients may not be able to really engage in more movement exercises that require, you know, distances, for example, or weights. Those patients could start off with flow-type movement, such as yoga, tai chi, things that are overall easier in terms of an overall energy expenditure, but can help get a foot in into becoming more active and building up that endurance to add in more activities as time progresses. Other patients, if possible, may choose to do things such as water aerobics. Just that sense of gravity is a little bit different in the water, and the resistance and strength training is also a little bit different. But again, it depends on your treatment modalities. You know, water aerobics may not be safe for some patients or may not be feasible for some patients depending on resection. Same thing with walking or using weights and things like that. So starting off slow and seeing how much you can tolerate and growing that endurance is a good method to start and get your foot in the door. You know, it might not be realistic to, you know, say, hey, go run 5 miles or something like that. That is difficult for many patients, if not many people. But starting off slow with attainable goals and improving on those goals or increasing those goals over a long period can help kind of gain that sense of endurance and tolerability, and overall in the long term decrease the levels of fatigue as well.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And then I have another question. A question for Dr. Trent. Do you have any tips on how to Um, But what is the best protocol for monitoring any recurrence of ES? And for how many years after treatment do you consider a native X-ray of chest as useful or at all, or should you rather have a CT scan instead?
Yeah, that's a great question. So for the distal epithelioid sarcomas, we tend to use MRI to monitor for recurrence. And for the proximal type, one could use MRI. We tend to use CT of the abdomen and pelvis. The resolution's a little bit better, and the image acquisition is much faster, so you don't see blurring from bowel movements, bowels moving around, or so that would be our approach for monitoring the primary site. The evaluating for distant metastases in the lungs may be a little more controversial. Some sarcoma experts, some sarcoma centers do CT of the chest every visit. Some do a baseline CT of the chest and then do a chest X-ray, anterior, posterior, and lateral, so two views of the plain chest X-ray for follow-up imaging, along with labs. So that would be the imaging. As far as the frequency, we generally start off every 3 months for a period of time, maybe 2 years, and then 4 months for 2 years, 6 months for a year, and then once a year after 5 years. We don't stop imaging. We continue to see patients annually after 5 years, just to continue to keep an eye on things, because there can be late recurrences with epithelioid sarcoma.
Excellent. This is a question actually for Dr. Kapadia. How can a patient caregiver identify a doctor to start a relationship with upon first diagnosis? Most specifically, how to know the difference between oncologist versus sarcoma specialist? Could you comment on that, Dr.
Kapadia? So that is a good question. Oftentimes, you know, if you live, let's say, and even patients who live in large cities, some patients who may not live in a large city often go to a community oncologist as a first kind of step. Oftentimes, when you see the community oncologist with the diagnosis of a sarcoma, I would speak with that, you know, provider frankly, and say, hey, you know, I know that sarcomas are intensive diagnoses, and oftentimes, you know, patients go to sarcoma specialists. Are there people that you know of or contacts that you have for an opinion with a sarcoma specialist? And usually that, you know, community oncologist will be able to provide someone, oftentimes at least within that state region, who may be more specialized into sarcomas. Oftentimes these physicians are usually at, you know, university or academic centers, which are a little bit more delineated in terms of subspecialties in oncology. Usually at these centers, oncologists are seeing a subset of medical oncology diagnoses. So sarcoma specialists oftentimes are seeing sarcomas. They may have a malignant heme specialist, a lung specialist, and whatnot. And so oftentimes the community practice or the private practice oncologist that patients usually get started with through referrals can find that person or help kind of connect them with one of those centers. There are also, of course, centers known throughout the country, such as Mayo, MD Anderson, City of Hope, that may have sarcoma specialists. These can also be avenues that could be researched. Sometimes some of these avenues, such as Mayo, may need more of a patient-led kind of research initiative where you look into their website and, you know, directly contact providers. But a good place to start is talking with your primary oncologist to see if they A, feel comfortable treating sarcomas, or B, know a sarcoma specialist within the state or their region that could be another resource or could be the primary oncologist for yourself.
Excellent. Thank you.
I agree with that. I would just add to it that the patient advocacy groups are also a great resource for, like, patient advocacy groups for sarcoma specifically, and organizations like Cancer Care can be very useful as well for information.
Excellent. So I just want to thank all of our speakers, and I also want to thank our participants. This has been an extraordinary call, I have to say that there are more questions. We couldn't get to all the questions. We got to lots of them. I'm going to ask our speakers to provide a takeaway, what we'd like you to take away from today's program. I'm going to start with Dr. Trench. Just a minute or so takeaway that you'd like people to take away from today's program.
Yeah, I would just reiterate what is in our national sarcoma guidelines, that if possible, patients should be with sarcoma, including epithelioid sarcoma, should be seen at a sarcoma center, an experienced sarcoma center of excellence, that they should have their pathology material reviewed by a sarcoma pathologist, and that us on the call today and most sarcoma experts are more than willing to field phone calls from community oncologists who'd like to ensure their patients are getting optimal care. And thank you, speakers, and thank you, attendees. And thank you, Carolyn.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And Dr. Miriam, your takeaway?
Yeah, I am honored always to participate and to hear from all the people who are experts in sarcoma and in care for people with sarcoma. I just want to say as well that there's so much important work that we've already done and we're continuing to do to improve treatment for people living with epithelioid sarcoma. And the most important thing really is the partnership that we have together, the partnership between physicians, patients, family members. We all can work together to make things better. And please reach out to your doctor or just learn more about clinical trials. Make sure you're seen by a sarcoma expert, and we're all going to keep moving forward together.
Well, thank you so much. And Dr. Kapadia?
I'd like to echo both what Drs. Miriam and Trent have said as well before. Thank you so much for having me as a part of this panel, and I really appreciate your guys' questions and insight. I'd like to reiterate that, you know, it takes a village, and the support, you know, finding support systems might be difficult at first, but be open with your providers, and hopefully we can find solutions to help find all the support members of your team that we can to really make this journey as tolerable as possible. Having support not just from your loved ones, but from your physicians, nutritionist, therapist, and as well as other holistic providers, all help in that healthcare journey. And you know, any bit of help that we can get throughout this journey and support is always appreciated. So be open with your providers so that we can help you find all those avenues to really help support your journey.
Oh, thank you so much. I want to thank our speakers, and I also want to thank our participants for asking such really great questions. But I do want to comment, and so this has been a phenomenal program, and it's one that we would hope to repeat again. Clearly, an important epithelioid sarcoma is an important sarcoma to discuss, so I think we are very grateful for the support we received from Ipsen Biopharmaceutical Inc. for really really funding this program today. And I do want to actually just comment on this. First of all, for those of you who got to ask a question, you know, please feel free to ask your question of your treating healthcare team. We've learned a lot from the program today. Take your question back to your treating healthcare team. And the same is true for those who didn't get to ask a question. You've learned a lot, take it back to your treating healthcare team. Also, we've discovered that many patients are able to reach their healthcare team during week hours, you know, during business hours. But usually weekends, evenings, and holidays are a problem. And so please always check with your healthcare team what number to call them, evenings, weekends, and holidays. Also, please know that you're not alone in coping with epithelioid sarcoma or any type of cancer. Please know that you're part of a community of support, and we are here to help you. You are not alone. And with that being said, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.